And a very good afternoon to you. It's 12:07, and this is Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter. Very happy to be with you on this first Thursday of December. Looking forward to a great show. And of course, we want to have you join our Outer Spaces conversation today. The number is 260-452-1185. You can always call us toll-free, of course, at 1-800-471-9264. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. And just a little bit later in the program, we'll be taking your plant and garden questions. Doug Hackbarth is with us in studio. He'll be part of the conversation today. Doug, we appreciate you being along.
Oh, you bet. Yeah, the weather now is cooling down a little bit, but I thought I saw 50s coming up again in a week.
We have a chance of touching 50 degrees, yeah. Tomorrow during the rain.
Is that it tomorrow?
Looking for mid-40s today, though. So
yeah.
It's still that warm weather sticking around just a little bit longer.
It's just amazing. I kind of like it, you know. A little cooler? Nah. This is perfect.
Joining us in studio as well, because it's the first Thursday of the month, it's Jason Kissel from Acres Land Trust. Jason, it's a pleasure to have you back at the Madge Rothschild Studios again.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
And every time you join us on this program, you bring an interesting topic for us to chat about and invite our listeners to be a part of. What did you bring? We were just talking about weather here. What did you bring this week?
Sure. It's really talking about how animals survive winter. How do you stay warm all winter? You know, we've just been talking, it's kind of nice outside, it's warm, but how would you like to spend all last night in a forest with no RV, no campfire, no external heat source, just what you brought into the forest? I don't know, it was maybe upper 20s last night, pretty cold, not bitter cold, but cold. And you had to stay there all night and still there today. It's, you know, almost approaching maybe 40 degrees. And you have to stay 98.6 degrees somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, imagine doing that for the next 3 to 4 months. And so we really want to talk today about how animals do that. I mean, there's some obvious ones, you know, but really getting more in depth to how does each little animal figure that out. And there's a lot of strategies that seem simple once we say them, but, you know, really just utilizing what's there. And they have to do this every single day all winter long. And it's pretty amazing.
And we want to hear from you during the first part of this program. What's the wildlife in your backyard doing to prepare for the colder season? Or are they? Are some animals just running around, just enjoying the warm weather, maybe jumping in your pool?
There's too many of them moving in my house.
Oh, no. Well, that's a problem, too.
Yeah.
We do want to hear from you. Of course, be a part of the conversation, 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. Okay, Jason, off the top of my head here, I mean, the easy ones, of course, you know, we will see them overhead. Birds, other animals will just migrate, just run away from the cold.
Sure. I mean, that's a great tactic if you can. You know, if it's getting cold and you don't like cold, move somewhere else or it's warmer. And so, you know, especially a lot of bird species just say, you know what, I'm not going to put up with this. I don't have the ability to stay here over winter. And so I'm going to keep going south until it feels warm enough to stay there. And so we are south for a lot of species, and a lot of species go even further south because they need even warmer than we are. And so, you know, we often think of migration going south and we think really far south, but we are south too. And so we really get some new birds in the winter that we don't see in the summer because we're warm compared to where they come from. And so there is. That's a great strategy. If you don't have to worry about it, just go somewhere else where it's warmer.
And depending on the day, you may see Doug Hackbarth heading south in his plane overhead one of these days.
That's right, and I'll have a blanket with me.
Well, it is a good point, though. I mean, even a lot of people do that.
Sure.
The snowbirds will stay summer in Indiana and head to Florida or to Texas or somewhere else when it gets a little cooler.
Yep.
Clarification,
sure.
Birds. Are they warm-blooded?
Yes.
And all the mammal-type animals are warm-blooded?
Correct.
What's cold-blooded? Fish?
Yeah, anything that really relies on its environment. They change their temperature with their environment. And so a lot of the amphibians and insects and things like that. So, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Another strategy, of course, if you can't run away from the cold, you can hide from the cold.
Yeah, you know, we think of obviously some hibernation, but there's not very many of our native species who actually hibernate. You know, you think of the classic bear, you know, that gets in the den and just stays there all winter. The only animals that we have locally here that really do that are the groundhogs and chipmunks. And even the chipmunks come up occasionally, so are groundhogs. But those two are some of the true hibernators we have here. Some of our mice species will do that, but the majority of the animals that are here are active all winter. And so hibernation is another strategy that people think of quickly, but you know, 98% of the animals that we have aren't taking advantage of that. They go in other ways. There's what's called daily hibernation, which is kind of topor. Mm-hmm. And what that means is they slow down their metabolism for a short time period. A lot of birds just do it at nighttime, and so they'll actually lower their body temperature at night, lower all their metabolism, and so they expend less energy at night. And a lot of mammals will do that too. Maybe it'll be for just a day or a few days, and then they kind of come back out, get active again. And so a lot of animals use that daily torpor to really just kind of – It's a temporary hibernation.
And let's extend this out just a little bit. Whether it's torpor or you know, full on hibernation, you're doing this to keep your body not quite as taxed for these long periods of time. But that it helps serve the season as well. You may not have as much access to food. You simply can't keep those resources going, 100% the whole time.
Exactly. You know, groundhogs are a good example. They really need green vegetation, and there's not hardly much green vegetation over the winter. And so a great strategy for them is to get as fat as you can in September and October, crawl in your hole and wait there until spring starts to pop up new green things that you can eat. And so that's their strategy. They fatten up, get this huge fat reserve, slow their body down enough where they're not burning that fat as quickly. Had they maintained their normal activity and no food, they would die. And so they slow their body down. Their heart rate is barely beating. I forget their heart rate during the winter, but I mean, it is slow. And so they're able to reduce their body temperature. A lot of animals run much higher than we do. Most animals run over 100, some 104, birds about 105. And so they run hot. You know, and to be able to maintain that all winter is hard. And so the hibernating animals, and even the ones that go into daily torpor, they have the ability to lower their operating temperature down by 20 or 30 degrees, which really decreases their energy output. That alone is an amazing chemical feat. It's an amazing just internal, I mean, that changes your whole body physiology. And to be able to do that on a daily basis is truly amazing.
I've got a couple of questions here. So in order to increase body temperature for humans, I think we eat. Mm-hmm. So would it help birds if you had food in the bird feeder? Would that help keep them warmer?
Yeah, I mean, birds have to eat. It's amazing how on the edge a lot of birds are. Birds can't store a lot of extra fat because then they can't fly very well. You know, look at a bird, they're pretty lean.
Right.
Especially the smaller species of birds. And they've really studied black-capped chickadees a lot in regard to how they survive winter. And they are almost on a daily verge of dying. What they do is they eat during the day as much as they can. Their body fat actually can increase quite a bit during the day. Then at night, they try to get in an area that's as well protected as they can be, fluff up their feathers to add a little more insulation, and then sit there and shiver all night long. They just sit there and their whole body trembles in order to build enough heat to sustain them through the night. Now, again, they're the ones that go into that daily torpor, and so they're able to reduce their temperature maybe from 105, maybe even down to the 90s or 80s in some cases.
Wow.
But you measure them in the morning again, and they've almost used up all their fat reserve that they had. And so they need to eat again that next day to survive that next night. And so, you know, it is really a life on the edge for the smaller birds. And that's why you see the smallest of the birds go into that daily torpor where larger birds don't have to. You look at a turkey, they got a lot of body mass. And so they're okay if they go a few days, you know, sitting there under the snow if they need to and don't have to eat every day. But you get these little birds that weigh a couple ounces. They really do need to find a food source every day. And so whether it's a backyard feeder or whether it's a natural source through the forest or through the wetlands, they really are leading that life on the edge and literally shivering all through the night. It doesn't seem to bother them. I mean, they go to sleep, they sit there and shiver, and in the morning their body regulates back up. They increase their core temperature, fly around, look for some food, and try to make it through the next night.
We want to hear from our listeners this hour, or during this part of the program, rather. What's the wildlife in your backyard doing these days? Give us a call. Share your thoughts. Share your stories. 260-452-1185. Or you can always call toll-free, of course, at 1-800-471-9264. Maybe you can post on our Facebook page or send us a tweet as well. One more of these before we have to go to a break here, Jason. And you kind of mentioned it already. You know, birds fluffing up their feathers, adding insulation. This is what a lot of animals do. Add a little extra layer of fat or add an outer coat, perhaps. I mean, largely this is what people do when we have to go outside.
Yep. And that's the animal's best defense, is whatever your skin or your fur or your feather coating is, you change it in the wintertime. And so if you look at a deer, for example, the amount of hair per inch in the summer is much less than the amount of hair per inch in the winter. It's a different coat, just like your dog sheds and changes coats. So do most fur-bearing animals. And so they put on a winter coat. And so what that coat is obviously more insulation. And then a lot of animals will actually apply a waterproofing to that. Because it's just like us, we could have a great coat on, and then we get wet, and it doesn't help much. And so a lot of animals excrete oil, put that on their feathers or put that on their fur, and that really helps keep the water out. And then once you've got this great insulation, many species have the ability to kind of fluff that up. Just like a feather pillow, it's better if you have some airspace in there. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see birds, you've seen them at your feeder sitting on, they get twice their normal size, this little, fluff ball sitting there. That's trapping air, which they can kind of heat up from their body temperature and keep that there and keep some of the cold air from coming in. So, there's a lot of natural strategies that they have just by beefing up their normal coat or their normal feathers.
And that's my excuse for eating a little bit more on Thanksgiving, too, is adding some insulation so I can survive the winter time. 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. We do have a caller on the line before we get to our break. Let's go to Tony. Tony, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Hi. Hey, I was outside yesterday afternoon. I live out in Hoagland. It's pretty quiet. And I heard a really strange noise. It almost sounded like a turtle dove noise, only really loud and really high in the sky. And I looked up, and there were probably, I took a picture, and you can just see dots, but there's probably 150 very large birds way up, and they were going south. And I'd never seen, they didn't look like geese, and they didn't sound like geese. But all the birds on the ground around me, I was outside, they all took off. So I don't know if they were some kind of predators. I have no idea what they would have been.
It was likely the sandhill cranes. They're migrating through our area right now, and they are a very big bird, and they travel in large flocks, really high in the air, too. Were they higher than you typically see, like geese flying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that's probably what it was, and they fly with their necks extended completely straight, and so they look really long. I mean, they are really long. They're about 5 foot when they're spread out like that.
Hmm. Would that sound make sense also then?
It would. They kind of have almost a prehistoric sound to them.
It was pretty creepy.
Yeah, it is. And it's amazing how loud it is considering how high they are. And so,
right. I've seen them around. We have a pond behind us and you see one or two, but I've never seen anything like that before. And like I said, it made the hair on my arms stand up.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that's what you saw. And in mid to late November, they congregate around Jasper Pulaski counties. And you'll see 10 to 20,000 of them sitting there. And they kind of stay there for a while. Some of them stay there longer, and then they kind of fly this time of year even further south. So I'm pretty confident that's what you saw. They're neat to experience.
Well, they look like the letter M, only like with rounded tops. It wasn't a V like geese or anything. And like I said, I've never heard a sound like that before.
Yeah.
Man, that sounds like you had an incredible experience there, Tony. Holy cow.
I was worried I'd never be able to figure out what it was, though. So, thanks. I would have never thought of that. Thank you very much.
Tony, we appreciate the call, and have a very good day.
You too. Appreciate the show.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye. 260-452-1185 is the local line to call if you want to get in touch this hour, or you can always call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. We do need to take a quick break. We'll continue this discussion in just a few moments, and in the second half of the hour, we'll take your plant and garden questions. Stay with us. It's Midday Matters.
Hi, I'm Julia Meekin. What up on this week's edition of Meet the Music? Double fine contemporary folk rock jazz vibes coming from the Wickersham Brothers and Brad Dourr and the Restless Spirits. That's Thursday night from 7 to 9 here at 89.1 FM or listen online at nipr.fm, a two-hour serving of homegrown delights here on Meet the Music.
Camden, New Jersey police can barely keep up with the city's crime, and the city says it can no longer afford their union contract, so the entire police force is being replaced.
This serves as the only viable vehicle for getting enough police officers on the streets of Camden so their citizens will have a fighting chance.
Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered airs weekday afternoons at 4 on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Judd Apatow has directed films about people who have trouble growing up, like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. But he takes on adulthood, marriage, and parenthood in his new film, This Is 40, starring his wife, Leslie Mann, and Paul Rudd. We'll talk about the characters' lives and Apatow's own life on the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
When temperatures drop, shelters provide a hot meal and a warm place to sleep. But it can be tough to convince people used to living on the streets to come indoors.
Where are you going to stay tonight?
I stay outside. We sleep outside.
But it's so cold. Don't you want to come in?
I'm Ari Shapiro, helping the homeless find shelter in the cold. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
It's 12:25. This is Midday Matters on WBOI. I'm Sean Beter, and this is the Outer Spaces edition of our program. Just a bit later in the hour, we'll ask you to call in with your plant and garden questions. Right now, though, we're talking with Doug Hackbarth and Jason Kissel of Acres Land Trust about tactics that animals and other wildlife use to stay warm in the wintertime. And we want to know what's going on in your backyard, particularly on the wildlife front. Are animals where you live preparing for the season, or maybe they got tricked by the weather? Give us a call. It's 260-452-1185. Or you can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. We had a great question from Tony right before the break. We have a question here, though, from Cheryl. Cheryl says, there's a lot of bird activity in my backyard, especially sparrows who hang out in the brush pile. I've witnessed some of the birds, like nuthatches, catching, hiding seeds for later on. What other bird species perform this action, Jason?
Yeah, it's kind of limited to the northern species, the ones that are going to stay here, you know, and chickadees do that a lot. Like you said, nuthatches, even some of the larger birds like jays and crows will do that. And it's not necessarily a very long-term storage. It's, hey, I've got more here than I can eat today, and so let me put it here, and then they'll eat it within the next few days. And so it's more of a short-term storage than I'm going to put this here and come back to it 2 months later. And so that's kind of their behavior that they do there. But, yeah, there's several birds who will do that.
I mean, it does. Is that the same story for mammals? You know, a lot of times we talk about, say, squirrels, putting away nuts for the winter, that sort of thing. Is that more of a short-term storage?
Well, they can really have a more long-term. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you bury something there, it can last for quite a while. But the nuthatches and the chickadees, they normally will tuck it under at least a piece of loose bark or something like that. Something else is going to find that pretty quick. You know, there's a lot of other birds. There's flying squirrels. There's other squirrels that are going to find that fairly, and so they know that they need to come back to that pretty quick. When you bury something, some mammals can have food caches that they do for quite a while. Beavers, for example, just other things will guard their food cache too, larger carnivores and things like that. So
we appreciate the question, Cheryl. Thank you very much. And anybody else who would like to share what's going on in their backyard, do give us a call, 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. Doug, I know you have a burning question we're going to get to in just a moment here. But Jason, you and I were talking over the break here. We were talking earlier on about birds, and there's a little bit extra that you didn't share with us in terms of birds keeping themselves warm.
Sure. You know, birds are amazing because, again, we talked about how small they are. You know, if you're a few ounces and need to remain 105 degrees, how do you do it? You know, and so they have all kinds of different mechanisms. And one we didn't discuss yet was their legs. You know, you look at a bird leg and we make fun of people. So you got bird. I've been accused of that a lot. You know, you got bird legs, Jason. And what that means, you have very skinny legs, and birds do. And so the only protection they have against the weather is these little scales that they have on their legs. Most of them don't have a lot of feathers. And so what they do is they reduce the amount of blood coming from their body into their legs, for the simple reason that if you kept putting a normal amount of blood into your legs, it's going to cool off. And so that blood, time it goes down to your toes and your claws, comes back up your leg, it's going to be a few degrees cooler than when you put it down your leg. And so they actually restrict the amount of blood going through their legs during the coldest parts of the day, even during the day, in order that when that blood comes in, they're not mixing as much cold blood. And so they're still pushing blood through their legs, but not nearly at the same volume because it gets cooled off. I mean, that's just, it's like a spigot that they can regulate on their legs to say, okay, blood, you're going to stay here, but not so much is going to go to the legs right now because it's coming back too cold. I mean,
that's an incredible trick of biology, really. I mean, and it seems like every time you're on the program, you know, that's kind of the point we get back to, is that there are always systems built into, people, of course, but animals, other flora and fauna as well.
It is. And, you know, that's why places like Acres Land Trust exist, you know, to preserve pockets of these areas so people can go. And then again, it's easy just to brush the surface and say, oh, I want to learn what that tree is, or I want to learn what that animal is. But you could have a PhD in any aspect of the chickadee that we've been talking about. You could specialize in its feathers and how they're built and how they have these little locking mechanisms that push them together. Or you could specialize in just the circulation pattern of a chickadee and get a whole PhD on that, you know. And so nature is so diverse, and we have so much to learn from nature. That's what's so exciting to me, is what if we could start engineering some of these things to do that? What kind of human benefit would that have? Another great adaptation to winter is some of the insects and frogs that literally can freeze solid and then thaw out. We've been trying to do that through science fiction for years. You know, that's what science fiction is made of. Hey, let's freeze this person and, you know, reanimate them in 100 years.
Sure.
Wood frogs are doing that in our forest right now. You know, they will literally freeze, and they've got this great ability to become diabetic. They get this blood sugar content that would kill us, kill almost any other creature, but they put so much sugar in their blood that it becomes an antifreeze. And so they can be below zero, solid block of ice, and then their cells don't burst. They have enough ability to take some of the water content out of their individual cells, replace it with this sugar that doesn't freeze solid, and so the cell wall doesn't burst. And then again, another part of that we haven't figured out yet is, after you freeze a cell well, how do you unthaw it well? And they figured that out. And so there's all kinds of studies, you know, scientists trying to figure that out, because, wow, wouldn't that be really neat if we could do that with not only people, but other things. So it's amazing what happens out there when you look at any species. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a plant or an animal, and how they cope with anything that comes at them.
We're talking about how wildlife stays warm in the wintertime with Jason Kissel from Acres Land Trust and, of course, Doug Hackbarth. We want you to join the conversation. Of course, just in just a few minutes here, we'll be asking you to call in with your plant and garden questions. The number 260-452-1185 or 1-800-471-9264. Doug, go ahead.
Well, now I have another question. Going back to the bird legs, okay? And how they slow the regulation of the blood because it keeps it warm. But I'm looking at this and thinking of a different angle on this deal. Let's say you're sitting in a chair and you cross your legs. You restrict the blood flow in your leg. Your leg goes to sleep, and it literally becomes numb.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible when they restrict the blood flow into their legs actually become numb? And that helps. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just the thought that mm-hmm. occurred to me. And of course, they could make those little skinny legs go numb fast.
Yep. Yep.
I guess if you watched them walk and they fell down like I do when I get up.
I mean, I would think, at those coldest points of the winter, they are not going to be moving around that much, not really going to be really using their legs either. So, if they are numb, they can just kind of set them down and take a nap, I suppose.
Yeah, well, it was just a thought when you said that, restricting the blood, that's basically what we do when we cross our legs and they go to sleep. The other thing that I had in mind was addressing pets, for example. These are also, especially the ones that are outside. If you have a cat that you leave outside, I see cats get real cold. And a lot of people have dogs that they leave outside. A lot of people don't, but there's plenty who do. And, of course, we all know dog houses is what helps them.
Yep.
You don't generally see structures for cats.
Yeah.
They generally find their own place to nest. They'll climb in the garage and things like that. But I don't know.
I mean, and that's a great example of they will find a place. I mean, they are wild animals. Now, again, if you have one that you keep in a house, you just don't want to throw him outside and say, hey, he's fine. He'll take care of it because they get kind of acclimated to just like we do. But if you've got an animal that lives outside year round, they'll figure it out. They'll find a place. And, and that's what all the wild creatures do. And so, again, if you are a flying squirrel looking for somewhere to sleep tonight, you're going to learn very quickly on what to look for. And so they often will find a hollow in a tree, some kind of a hole in a tree structure. And they quickly learn, you know what? I think I'd rather have a hole on the south side of the tree than the north side of the tree. And they've learned that's great for two reasons. One, the coldest wind in the winter comes from the north. That's where it's coldest. And when you get wind from the north, it's going to be colder. So you don't have this hole on the north side blowing in all this cold air. You're kind of blocked by the wind. Another great advantage to having a hole on the south side of the tree is that's where the most sun is in the winter. You're going to have that sun beating on the edge of that hole all day long. You're going to have actually some sunlight penetrating down in there. But more importantly, it's going to be warming up that side of the tree a few degrees hotter than the north side of the tree. And so they've learned through trial and error or through instinct that, not only am I looking for a hole in a tree, but I'm looking for this particular thing. I want it to be on the south side of the tree. Another good thought is I want it to be only as big as I can fit through. Because if I can fit through it, then I could probably take on whoever else is going to come in. They're going to be my same size or littler. If I go in this huge hole, something bigger than me is going to come in here and either eat me or kick me out. So again, when you're looking for a hole, they're not looking for any hole. They're looking for a hole that meets their specific needs. And so they're very smart, and they learn what to take in that hole. If they're going to keep coming back to that, they'll start bringing stuff in there that's going to stay dry, add some extra insulation, And so it's just amazing to look at any single animal and try to figure out how it's going to make it through the winter. And if you start observing that animal, you'll start to see these little characteristics that they do. You might see this same flying squirrel come out and sit on a rock. And what in the world is that thing doing? Well, it knows that rocks sitting in the sun are going to absorb some heat. And so it might just sit on that rock because it's a half a degree cooler than everything else around it. And so if you start putting a critical eye to your observations, you'll start to know, oh, well, I bet it's doing that because of this. There's always a reason. They're not going to waste any movement.
And so often, I mean, with dogs, cats, flying squirrels, so many animals, I mean, we focused on specific systems for keeping warm here, but very often it's whatever you can do
to, oh, exactly.
to keep warm, a mixture of these systems. Well, yeah. Jason Kissel, it's always a pleasure to talk about these things on the program. Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
We're going to take a quick break here for the news. When we return, we'll take your plant and garden questions. So get those ready and give us a call, 260-452-1185, or you can call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation when we get back.
Judd Apatow has directed films about people who have trouble growing up, like The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up. But he takes on adulthood, marriage, and parenthood in his new film, This Is 40, starring his wife, Leslie Mann, and Paul Rudd. We'll talk about the characters' lives and Apatow's own life on the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah D'Elia with WBOI News. U.S. Senator Richard Lugar is preparing to announce his plans for the future after spending 36 years in the Senate. The Indiana Republican will reveal his plans during a news conference Friday afternoon at the University of Indianapolis. The university might be part of those plans. University President Robert Manuel will join Lugar at the news conference. The university on the south side of Indianapolis will host the 36th Lugar Symposium for Tomorrow's Leaders on Saturday. The symposium brings together more than 400 high school juniors from across Indiana to discuss a variety of domestic and international topics. Lugar will give an address that he considers his most comprehensive of the year. A state panel has voted to make it easier for non-education majors who earn bachelor's degrees to get teaching jobs. That's one part of a broad package of changes to Indiana's rules for teacher licensing the State Board of Education approved Wednesday. As State Impact Indiana's Kyle Stokes reports, opponents fear the new standards sets the bar too low.
The State Board's final 9-2 vote ends months of debate on the proposal known as REPA 2. State education officials say the new guidelines give schools more flexibility in the teacher hiring process. State Superintendent Tony Bennett says the rule changes remove licensing as an obstacle to the teaching profession for non-traditional applicants.
The more opportunities we have to provide our school leaders the ability to bring talent into Indiana classrooms, talent into Indiana school buildings, talent into Indiana school corporations, is good public policy.
REPA 2 also allows current teachers to become certified to teach in new content areas without taking additional coursework. All they'd have to do is pass an exam. Building administrators are no longer required to have a master's degree. But REPA 2 also caused controversy. After overwhelmingly critical public comment this summer, state education officials removed some of the proposal's most contentious points, such as a provision that would have based a teacher's ability to renew a license on evaluation results. IU School of Education Dean Gerardo Gonzalez says the revisions did improve the final package, but
this is not a political trade-off. We are talking about the education of students. We're talking about kids who need adults in those classrooms who are well prepared. Why lower the standard? Why lower the bar?
State Superintendent-elect Glenda Ritz attended the state board meeting in Indianapolis Wednesday. She opposed REPA 2 during her campaign and, in remarks to the board, asked members to table the proposal until she took office. They declined. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Kyle Stokes.
Hoosier mayors are calling on state government and the General Assembly to return more control to local government, giving them the flexibility and resources to address concerns in cities and towns across the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the Indiana Conference of Mayors' new Trust Local campaign.
Whiting Mayor Joe Stahura, president of the State Conference of Mayors, says there's been a disturbing trend emerging in the last few years. More and more decisions he says belong on the local level are being taken over by the legislature.
We don't want them fighting home battles in the State House. You know, let us handle the local stuff at home. Zoning issues, water rights, there's thousands of financial flexibility. You know, those issues we can handle. We don't need the help.
The mayoral coalition is pushing three initiatives in the upcoming legislative session: allocating more gas tax revenue to fund road and street improvements, making pseudoephedrine a prescription drug to help curb the state's methamphetamine problem, and giving local governments more power to require banks to maintain foreclosed properties. Terre Haute Mayor Duke Bennett says coalition mayors want to partner with the legislature and be trusted to make more decisions themselves.
Trust us locally, that we really know what's going on in the trenches, and we'd like to have a voice at the table to get this passed through the legislature in this session.
Stahura says the bipartisan effort is not meant to pit state and local government against each other. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
You're listening to 89.1 FM WBOI. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and now back to Midday Matters.
It's 12:42. This is Midday Matters on WBOI Fort Wayne. I'm Sean Beter, along with Doug Hackbarth and Jason Kissel from Acres Land Trust. And this hour, we've been talking about animals and other wildlife in general, keeping warm in the wintertime. The phone lines are open if you have a plant or garden question you'd like to get on the show. Give us a call, 260-452-1185, or toll free at 1-800-471-9264. Of course, you can always email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet. It's at middaymatters. We've had a very patient caller on the line with a question for Jason. Mary, good afternoon. You're on the program.
Hi. I wonder what turtles do all winter.
That's a very, very good question. I was actually wondering the same thing.
Well, and they're interesting, too. I'll talk mainly about aquatic turtles. There are some land turtles, but the aquatic turtles in late October, normally, what they do is dive down into wherever they're near. Say they're in a pond. They'll kind of dive down into the pond, take one last gulp before they go down, and then they just burrow into the mud. And that seems strange because we all know that turtles have lungs. I mean, they breathe air. You know, they come up. You see them all summer long coming up breathing air. But they don't take another breath until spring. How they're able to do that is, again, the mud kind of insulates them. And so it's not as cold as being outside or near the surface of the water. And then once the pond freezes over, that adds even more insulation to the water. But they slow way down. You know, their body really slows down, their heart rate barely pumps at all, and they are really just in a kind of a hibernation state. And so they don't need as much oxygen. But the only way they get their oxygen during that time is they absorb it through special linings in their mouth and a little bit into their throat. And so they don't really swallow the water, but they bring it in enough where they can get some oxygen from the water through that way. And so they never breathe all winter long. I mean, it's amazing. Like,
wow.
I said before,
it's crazy.
Any species you look at and how they make it through the winter is just unreal. You know, for an animal who breathes air the rest of the year to be able to take one last breath and stay under there for months at end, and a lot of frogs do the same thing. They absorb oxygen actually through their skin instead of through their mouth. And so that's a great question. And some of the land turtles do a similar thing, but they do it underground rather than underneath the water.
Mary, a fantastic question. Thanks for giving us a call.
Okay, thank you.
All right, have a very good day. 260-452-1185 is the local line. If you have a plant or garden question, or you want to update us on what's going on with the wildlife in your backyard, of course, you can always email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or send us a tweet at Midday Matters. And Doug, I know you had a fantastic transition between animals and plants here.
Well, you know, Jason was talking about how these animals, which are mammals, prefer holes on the south side. They prefer things where the sun's going to hit them up in the wintertime and warm them up to some degree. And we can understand and relate to that because we're humans. But now when we talk about plants, we have to not think like a mammal, not think like a human or one of these animals, and we have to start thinking like a plant because plants are totally different. They're not warm-blooded. Okay,
they're not any blooded.
No, so when you cover a plant, it's not going to hold heat in because you covered it. It doesn't make heat like a human would do. You put a blanket on, you get warm because you're making heat and trapping it. They don't make heat. So the thing about plants in the wintertime is they're totally the opposite. They like the ones that live up, you know, when you're up north where it's cold, they want to freeze and then they want to stay frozen. The sun will defrost them. You and I like that. The plants don't like it. Every time they get defrosted and refreeze, it's bad for them. Let's think about meat in the freezer. You take it out and defrost it and then stick it back in the freezer. Take it out and defrost it and put it back in the freezer. We all know that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
You don't do that. And plants, they want to get frozen and stay that way. Therefore, that's why a lot of times when people say, well, where do I plant a rhododendron or an azalea? And we'll tell them, put it on the north or northeast side. And that's not because they don't like sun. They love it. It's not because they don't like heat. They love it. It's because they don't like sun and heat in the wintertime. And the north or northeast side is the best two places to be. The west and the south are the warmest, the wrong place to go with plants. So there's how that works.
You should run transitions professionally.
There you go.
Looks like we have a few callers on the line here. And, of course, if you want to join the conversation, the number 260-452-1185 or toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. Looks like we've got Ryan on the line. Ryan, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon, guys. How you doing?
Good. Hi, Ryan.
Well, I bought my wife a rose plant a couple years ago, and it's been doing really well. And about maybe a year ago, halfway through the summer, I started getting the infamous black spot disease.
Sure.
And I've tried some different sprays. I can't think of the names of what sprays or whatever, but it hasn't went away. It comes back midsummer. It does have full exposure. It looks really great. It blooms awesome. But I just can't get rid of it. I actually heard recently that I should, you know, make sure I get rid of the leaves that actually fall. They die and, you know, fall on the ground.
That's right.
But I don't know what else to do. I don't know if you could maybe recommend a spray or something that you know that works, or maybe
I can do all that. And you're right on track with the timing of this thing. It's mid-season. You start getting the black spot. What happens is in the spring, things wake up in the morning kind of damp, but then the sun comes out and they dry up and the foliage is just coming on and it hasn't got a disease. It's not left over from last year, although the dirty leaves on the ground can have this disease, and it is important to always clean up in the fall so you don't start off bad. Always start off clean, which is what normally happens. But what happens then by mid to late summer, then all of a sudden, dust has settled on the foliage, which is a growing place for this bacteria. But also, as we get past the hump of summer, all of a sudden we start waking up to dew again. Remember, in the summer, we wake up and the grass is dry. There's no dew on the grass. As long as there's no dew, you're probably not going to have a black spot problem unless you're running sprinklers or you're watering late at night or you're spraying water on the foliage at night. See, nighttime watering, this is what causes things like that to happen. But once we get past that hump of summer and then the dew starts showing up on your grass, that's your trigger point. It's time to spray these plants with a protective spray to keep them from getting these problems. And so you can use organic things such as, I'll think of it in a second. What is it? It's not lime. Well, give me a minute to think about it. But what we use at the greenhouse when we spray these things is we use this product called Triple Action because it's an insecticide, a miticide, and a fungicide all in one. So it helps to protect from fungus. It helps to protect, I thought of the other product. It helps to protect from insects all at the same time. And this is something you might have to do on a weekly basis, although when you have a drought season, you'd think not. Except every morning you have this dew, and that's what helps to make this stuff grow. The organic stuff is sulfur. You can get sulfur, and you can dust it on lightly, or you can mix it with water and spray it on. And what happens is the water evaporates, and a thin coating of lime remains. I have a product in the greenhouse that we use. You can't buy it. Excuse me. A product in the greenhouse that we use that we actually take one of these little blow torches. It comes in a tin can, and we light it with the blowtorch. It's a powder. And we'll light about 4 cans of this stuff in our greenhouses. I do this just before the poinsettias come into bloom, and we leave. And what this stuff does is it burns, and it actually, in the smoke, it has this powder that's in the can floating around. And it very, very gently settles down on the foliage, which protects these poinsettias from getting a type of black spot. And the reason I brought it up is to let you understand how lightly the coating needs to be. Incredibly light.
Okay.
You can just imagine when this settles on the foliage, you can't even see it. It's so light.
All right. Well, Ryan, good luck with the cure here. Hopefully things get a little bit better.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
All right. Have a very good day. Thank you very much. 260-452-1185 is the number to call, or you can always call us toll-free at 1-800-471-9264. Looks like we have another caller waiting on the line. We have Ani. Did I get that right?
Yes, yeah.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I have a lawn question. For the last several years, we've had one patch right adjacent to our driveway that started out in sort of a horseshoe shape of the grass just started to die.
Mm-hmm.
And with every succeeding year, the horseshoe gets bigger. And it's now probably maybe 10 feet across. And my husband has tried fungicides. We looked to see if maybe it was grub worms that were chewing the grass off at the roots, and that didn't seem to be the problem. It's just very odd. There's just this horseshoe-shaped circle where grass won't grow.
Yes, yes. I've heard of this. Jason, do you know anything about this? I've heard of this. You may not be a lawn person, and I've heard of this happening, and there are some fungicide products that you can buy that are slow release that I would recommend that you apply to your yard, especially in the spring season. You don't have to rush out there like with crabgrass preventer and put it on in April. You can wait till maybe sometime in mid to late May or early June. And it's a granular type thing, just like when you put weed and feed on and you use a broadcast spreader, you would use a broadcast spreader for this fungicide too. And TerraChlor is one, but there's more modern types of fungicides that can be applied to the yard. And I would do it as a cautionary, protective reason, especially since you know you have this problem year after year. And if you know where this area is, it comes up every year at the same time. I don't know. It seems like you might want to go out there and rake that area too and try to rake up whatever you can and haul that away and then put this fungicide down. There's liquid fungicides that come in hose-on sprayers. You simply clamp it on your hose and go out there and spray. Those will work fast, whereas the granular type will work slower, but it will last all rest of the summer. Jason's got a comment here.
Well, and this may not apply in this case, but I had someone who had a similar experience, and it was actually what happened was is they had zoysia grass introduced into their regular fescue grass. Hmm. And when you said it was next to a driveway, is the grass being killed mid-season where everything else is well, or are you seeing it die just earlier in the fall?
Well, it doesn't even come up.
Okay.
It's just sort of a bare pen. Now, it looks like there's some other grass that's kind of filling in, but it's essentially just a big bare spot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Well, then I would do the raking, and then I would overseed with some fresh grass seed, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you might look at what you're using on the driveway in the winter. It could be that if that's a drainage spot where your salt that you're putting on your driveway is going or things like that, sometimes it can be just some kind of environmental issue, too, especially since you're seeing kind of a half-moon pattern and coming from the edge of a driveway. Sometimes you might just want to look at what's going on around there, too. But it does sound like it's probably a fungal issue.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, and one fungicide is as good as another?
I think so. I'm pretty convinced that, if you listen to the people who manufacture them, they'll tell you theirs is the best, but they're all pretty good. I feel the same way about fertilizers, too. Most of them are pretty much the same. And when someone says, well, you need a high-acid fertilizer, well, yeah, use a high-acid fertilizer one time. Use a general-purpose one time. If you switch them around, you're actually getting more nutrients to the plant. A more variety of nutrients. I think it's good. But, yeah, I think one fungicide's probably as good as another.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Bonnie, we appreciate the call. Have a good day.
Don't get me wrong, Sean. There are fungicides that are specific for certain fungus, and there's other fungicides that are specific. But when we're talking yard work and stuff like that, it's a general-purpose fungicide or all-purpose, which means it'll probably take care of the problem.
We have just a few moments here. I know Bruce is waiting on the line, but we have a few Facebook questions as well. I want to kind of speed through here, both for Jason. We were talking earlier about squirrels, Jason. Heather wants to know how they find their stash after they bury it for the colder months.
And that's not real clear, but a lot of it is just memory, some memory of that. And it's pretty important to you. So you want to remember where your food is. But they forget a lot, thankfully, for oak generation. They kind of count on animals burying acorns and forgetting them. So it's not foolproof. And a lot of times they'll have one central cache, where it be in a store of a tree or in a particular hole. And so they kind of remember where those big piles are.
All right. Heather, we appreciate your posting on our Facebook page. Michelle says, lots of wildlife in the city in our central Fort Wayne Brookview neighborhood, just north of downtown. We have two natural parks, lots of wildlife all throughout the area. Question for Jason, though, how common are coyotes and beaver in the central city?
Yeah, coyotes are not... They're very opportunistic, and so they can take advantage of a lot of different habitats, including some suburban areas. You don't see them often in inner city areas because they've had to go through a lot of people to get there. You tend to see them on the edges of towns. Not that they can't be, especially if they have a good corridor like a river to make it that far into a downtown area. And kind of same thing with the beavers, although they're more apt to be in a central area if there's a river connecting them than the coyotes are.
Hmm. And they've got three rivers as corridors in this town.
Exactly.
Well, we are unfortunately out of time. This hour went fast, gentlemen. Jason Kissel from Acres, thank you so much for joining us on this first Thursday of the month. It's always a pleasure.
You're welcome.
And Doug Hackbar, thanks to you for coming by as usual.
Thank you. The time did fly.
It certainly did. We're sorry we couldn't get to everybody on the phone lines today. Do give us a call next week with your plant and garden questions. We'll be here same time, same station. I'm Sean Beeter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 HD Channel 1. This is WBOY Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. We're coming up on 1 o'clock. Fresh Air is up next. Have a great day.